The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin here with your twice-weekly diet of the wake-up call brought to you direct from Singapore and carried across the waves courtesy of Progressive Radio Network in New York City. Well, as you probably know, I spend a great deal of time looking at the various government reports and especially the payrolls report. And as pertains to Friday's Bureau of Labor Statistics report in the unemployment figures, if I wish to leave you with one takeaway, it is that the current use of the monthly headline number is more of a sales and PR program for Wall Street and the government, and hardly the product of serious and thoughtful analysis of statistical data. As far as the U.S. economy is concerned, it really is right now on a kind of flat line from all that I can tell, and I suspect as the next downturn kicks in serious degree, it will be blamed on Europe or some other factor. But, you know, the one important consideration that you need to know is that there has been no real recovery as of now. There is a huge discrepancy between the bond and equity markets in the manner in which they are interpreting the data. And one of them has to be wrong. And based on my simple experience of these things, it's really the bond people who are almost always the adults in the room. And since I led off my Friday show with a quick observation on the unemployment figures, which had been released 90 minutes earlier, I thought it might be appropriate for us to listen in on somebody else's interpretation, namely that of Charles Biederman of TrimTabs, which is one of the leading independent institutional research firms focused on the supply and demand of shares of stock and money available for investment. So, without further ado, let's listen in on Biederman and hear what he has to say about last Friday's unemployment report.
Hello from Sausalito, California. Today is Friday, February 3rd, 2012. I am Charles Biederman. Biggest headline for all financial media today is, and every media, is that the U.S. economy added a much more than expected 243,000 jobs in January and 446,000 combined over the past 2 months. That is many, many more new jobs than our estimate of less than 83,000 over the same period. Now, our estimate of a slowly growing economy, which is the same as the Fed's estimate, is based primarily upon income tax collections we track daily. We've been tracking daily withholding collections for 14 years now. Now, either there's something new we don't know in the income tax collection world, or there is something very, very suspicious about today's Bureau of Labor Statistics' wildly bullish and positive for the economy and the administration number. We continue to check and recheck our analysis of income tax collections. We're aware that another service says that incomes are growing faster than we do. So far, we've not found any errors or discrepancies in our work, but if we do, we will let you know. Now, each month, the BLS reports two data series, but only one jobs number is reported by the media. actual jobs outstanding, not seasonally adjusted, are down 2.9 million over the past 2 months. Now, it's only after seasonal adjustments made at the sole discretion of the Bureau of Labor Statistics economists that 2.9 million fewer jobs in 2 months gets translated into 446,000 more jobs, yes, seasonally adjusted for January and December. No one I know has any clue how the BLS does their seasonal adjustments. The BLS revises historic data every month for several months, who knows why, until actual payroll data is used to benchmark the BLS data, almost a year in arrears. In other words, the BLS currently has accurate data for March 2011 and before. Since then, who knows? I keep repeating that the BLS refuses to use real-time data embedded in daily income tax collections to be able to report real-time wages and jobs. Why do they refuse? Could the real reason possibly be because the jobs number is politically motivated? The entire world is looking at U.S. jobs creation as a proxy for how well President Obama is doing. Could the Obama administration be pressuring its economist employees to create the best possible jobs number? There's an election coming up. Obviously, I am quite suspicious of the numbers that I see in today's press release. Remember, most financial journalists and even stock market strategists do nothing more than rewrite government press releases. So do not expect very few others to question the good news as we're doing here. For those of you who care, look at Table B1, Total Non-Farm Employment, in today's BLS press release that's attached to this video on our blog site. Start with the not seasonally adjusted table that shows that in November 2011, there were 133.172 million actual jobs. Actual jobs dropped by 220,000 in December, and actual jobs dropped an additional 2.7 million in January. Only as a result of unknown seasonal adjustments could the BLS change 2.9 million less jobs to 243,000 more jobs. Yes, the labor market contracts during the winter and expands in the spring and summer. Could this number be manipulated? Of course it could. Is it? I don't know. Am I the only suspicious soul out there? I hope not. Certainly it is lonely right now.
Okay, we are back, and as always when I give you these snippets, they really speak for themselves. They don't really need much more help from me, but anyway, another opinion for you all to chew over. Well, Charles Hugh Smith had a fascinating take on the psychology of denial that has afflicted the United States in terms of its lack of desire to confront the issues. He has this to say. The mainstream view uniting the entire political spectrum is that all America's financial problems can be fixed by what amounts to top-down, centralized policy tweaks and regulation. For example, tweaking policies to tax the rich, limit the size of too-big-to-fail financial institutions, regulate credit default swaps, lower the cost of health care, limit the abuses of student loans to pay for online diploma mills, and on and on and on. But what if the rot is already beyond the reach of more top-down policy tweaks? Consider the recent health care legislation. Thousands of pages of obtuse regulations that require a veritable army of regulators staffing a sprawling fiefdom with the net result of uncertain savings based on a board somewhere in the labyrinth establishing best practices that will magically cut costs in a system that expands by 9% a year each and every year. A system so bloated with fraud, embezzlement, and waste that the total sum squandered is incalculable, but estimated at around 40% minimum. Does anyone really think that the lack of another centralized federal fiefdom and thousands of pages of additional regulation is what ails healthcare? Of course not. In effect, the United States as a society has completely lost the ability to honestly admit a problem exists and that the solution is not to paper it all over with more regulation and insatiable ever-rising debt-based funding paid for by its children and grandchildren and their children. Consider the national security state busily constructing rectangular mountains of office space to house its vast, unchecked, oversight-free empire. Does anyone actually know what tens of thousands of highly paid people are doing in all these sprawling fiefdoms of national security? And I don't mean the Pentagon or the NSA, the buildings sprouting all over the toadier bits of D.C. and its suburbia are the metastasizing results of the green light given to anything remotely connected to GWOT, the global war on terror, the war that by definition could never be declared, won, or even ended, the war that always requires more funding lest one event slip through the cracks. If nobody in the elected chain of command actually knows where all this black budget money is going, what are the odds it's being spent wisely and prudently? No meaningful oversight inevitably leads to abuse of budget and power. If we haven't learned that, then we are well on the way to financial and political self-destruction. Consider the Glass-Steagall Act, at 37 pages in length, and the 2,319-page monstrosity of corrupted federal power, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Back in December, Nick Schultz helped put the size of the most consequential 2,074-page healthcare bill into some historical context by comparing its length to some previous bills that rank among the most consequential in U.S. history, like the 82-page Social Security Act of 1935 and the 74-page Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now that Congress has passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, it might be a good time to compare the 2,319-page financial reform bill, 245 pages longer than the health care bill, to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, 31 pages that are considered among the most consequential legislative act for banking and finance, or the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 at 37 pages. Though few have delved into the ramifications of this monstrous power grab, it seems that the executive branch has grabbed potentially unprecedented powers with little, if any, oversight by Congress, all in the supremely Orwellian pursuit of consumer protection. If a 37-page bill took care of the problem in 1933, why can't the same 37-page bill be reenacted? Why, indeed? The reason is that the bill impedes the flow of public funds to favored cartels and opportunities for financial looting by these cartels. And so a monster is created that nobody understands and which limits or simply overwhelms oversight by elected officials outside the imperial presidency. The entire financial and political infrastructure is corrupt. Perhaps it is time to note that the most thoroughly, venally, persuasive corrupt nations on earth have all have abundant regulations against corruption. Regulations don't stop or limit corruption, fraud and embezzlement by magic. Healthcare is beyond being fixed by thousands of pages of policy tweaks, limitations, and regulations. The financial system is beyond being fixed by thousands of pages of arcane regulations that only serve to obfuscate the looting and predation while enshrining another vast financial federal fiefdom that harvests the national income while accomplishing nothing of substance. Regulation only functions if the culture and the society have a value system and a will to enforce it. The American people have lost those values and the will. Complicity reigns supreme. Instead, we support going through the motions of adding layers of bureaucratic bloat and listening to soaring rhetoric from bloviated politicos who promise us prosperity, recovery, and all the rest without any sacrifice or engagement. Going through the motions never solved anything. 2,000-page regulatory thickets are one thing, and one thing only: purposeful obfuscation via complexity. A profound realization hit me last night. America is just going through the motions now of reform, of healthcare, of everything. America's leadership, both its elected and appointed officials, and its shadow financial power elite leadership, the corporatocracy of crony capitalist and rentier speculative parasites, are just going through the motions of financial reform. And the American public is resigned to just going through the motions of accepting the travesty of a mockery of a sham that is called reform, too, even as they understand in their bones that nothing has been fixed and that the next financial crisis has already been cooked into their future. One of the few reliable voices of reason in the world of finance, Simon Johnson, has already laid bare how the next financial crisis and inevitable bailout of the banking parasites will unfold. His article in the New Republic, Way Too Big to Fail, reveals how the too-big-to-fail banks have shredded the wet paper bag of reform Congress went through the motions of conjuring up. They are quickly expanding globally beyond the reach of any mere nation-state's grasp. Let's be honest, shall we? There never was any fire for real reform of the financial sector. It was all rote, a foul, stupid play-act, a passionless pantomime of caring and fake progressiveness displayed for propaganda purposes. Real reform occurs when the political class of toadies, sycophants, leeches, and cowards is forced by a near-universal public outrage to pass simple, powerful legislation and the budgetary resources to enforce that legislation. For example, the landmark environmental laws of the 1970s, rivers in America, used to catch fire before this federal legislation. Now they don't. There was a true passion and desire in the nation to clean up the industrial pollution that was destroying the nation's commons. There was no real fire for financial reform in the politico class. All they had to do was wait out the public's outrage over TARP and then get down to the business of collecting contributions from financial players and their armies of toady lobbyists. So Washington went through the motions of reform, and the regulatory agencies went through the motions of enforcing existing regulations. But nobody was indicted. No RICO suits filed on behalf of the defrauded. No billion-dollar penalties slapped on those who carted off tens of billions in embezzled, ill-gotten gains. And no perps forced into bankruptcy. In other words, nothing got done except another layer of useless, overpaid bureaucracy was added to the bloated, overstuffed federal payroll. The exact same dynamic is visible in the healthcare reform. 2,000 pages of mind-numbing slicing and dicing of the vast flood of national treasure that flows to the healthcare cartels, and nary a single word of the actual health of the American public, which continues to deteriorate on multiple fronts. The so-called reform is to add multiple layers of bureaucracy and additional costs on a bloated, out-of-control system in which 50% of the money is already wasted on fraud, needless procedures and meds and paper shuffling. It was all about going through the motions of reforming a system everyone knows is beyond dysfunctional. The painful truth is that we are far beyond the point where policy, legalist, regulatory tweaks will actually fix what's wrong with America. The rot isn't just financial or political. Those are real enough. But they are mere reflections of a profound social, cultural, yes, spiritual rot. This is the great illusion, that America's financial and political crises can be resolved with top-down, centralized financial reforms of one ideological flavor or another. It is abundantly clear that the crises extend far beyond a lack of financial of regulation or policy tweaks. We cling to this illusion because it is easy and comforting. The problems can all be solved without any work or sacrifices on our part. Our complicity in the corruption is never mentioned. Our votes for kleptocratic political toadies who promise us that our share of federal swag will not be sacrificed, our interest payments to the banking cartel oligarchy, our acceptance of bogus statistics, bogus reforms, and ceaseless propaganda as legitimate, and lastly, our silence in the face of destructive deficits, lest our share of the swag be cut. This is how once great empires and toothless regulations are passed by bought and paid for legislatures for the purposes of perception management, and a population addled by constant entertainments and staged combats in the Colosseum listlessly pursues their right to bread and circuses of distraction. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's one of Charles Hugh Smith's better renditions, and I was proud to be able to bring it to you today. So there you have it, Charles Hugh Smith. Okay, let me give you my information very quickly. To start with, our toll-free number at 888-874-4888. Once again, the toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Please feel free to use it whenever you have the occasion to pick up a phone during this precious hour of our wake-up call. The hour is yours, ladies and gentlemen. Make the best use of it that you can. However, if you do not wish to call, you may email, as several people have already done, and the email address is rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's RM for Richard Martin, at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my personal number for you to call in if you wish to talk about your personal issues. Please feel free. I am here at your beck and call. Call free. Call any time during the 24-hour period. If I'm not around, leave a message, including a phone number and a name, and I will call you back as soon as I possibly can. And the number is in Sarasota, area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, let me just remind you that on the 26th of February, that's in 3 weeks' time, which is a Sunday at 2 p.m., the sixth meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group will take place in New Brunswick, New Jersey, at the same venue as before, the George Street Ale House at 378 George Street, New Brunswick. And Sue, who is our moderator, is standing by to take your calls indicating your desire to be present and also to answer any questions that you may have. And her number is 202-246-5131. And again, that's Sue at the telephone waiting for your calls at 202-246-5131. That's again Sunday, February the 26th in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I've already had a conversation with a couple of people, some have already who are now making active plans to leave, and one particular person has said that she would be kind enough to grace the meetup group again to explain some of the steps that she's going through in order to leave the country and to set up residence elsewhere. So even those of you who may think that you have done what is needed, please do come and share your experiences with the group, because the group is an active group. They are all interested, and they do need your moral support. This is not a decision taken lightly to leave the U.S., and I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have the inklings of a mind to leave the country, you will be overwhelmed with good information by coming to the group. So please, come to the group on Sunday, the 26th of February in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and let us hear from you at that point. Well, somebody wrote to me, and unfortunately, I don't have the name. I must have forgotten to write it down, so I don't know who wrote this email to me, but I bring it to you, and I apologize to the author, but whoever it is, thank you very much for it. And it reads as follows. I am a clinical psychologist with 14 years of practice, and I'm sorry to say that Ron Paul responds positively to the very symptoms I see every day in the high-security mental health facility where I work. Refusal to live in a community, self-centeredness, emotional autism, tendency to believe in conspiracy theories, notably involving central banks or 9/11, tendency to think that the ends justify the means, tendency to think the problem comes from society and not from themselves, and total absence of compassion for others. He should seek treatment, really. I say that empathetically, for his own good. He is a menace not only to society, but first and foremost to himself. As a professional, I would recommend daily doses of aminazine, not more than 4 grams per dose, one in the morning, one in the evening, or an algogenic injection every 3 days, followed by 1 month of electroshock therapy. It has tremendous success in reversing the symptoms of psychosis, especially anarcho-capitalist psychosis, jargon term for when the patient desires the complete breakdown of society and the state structure. That is why he tends to attract as supporters people with known psychiatric disorders, goldbug doomers, nerdy conspiracy theorists, etc., the very same people who, after being exposed for what they are and placed into a public facility, still deny that there is something wrong with them and keep shouting that they are victims of some sort of government plot when the nurses come for their treatment or their shower. Well, thank you very much, whoever bestowed upon us those words of wisdom. I'm sure not many of us company present agree entirely with what you have to say, but in the interests of broad-mindedness, I bring you everything that comes my way, good or bad, left or right, up and down. Ladies and gentlemen, you have it full frontal. That is a Ron Paul opponent at work. So be it. Let him sing the praises of whatever is closest and dearest to his heart. I shall never fail to bring to you the opinions of all and sundry. And with that, I think it's time to go for our break. And so we shall so do, and I will be right back. Okay, we are back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you have doubts about the attitudes of Gen Xers that are different from the attitudes of boomers, there is one clear, measurable difference. This is a huge, major, enormous difference between the Gen X culture and the boomer culture. And this is the difference that makes the Gen X culture so toxic. You know, when the savings and loan crisis occurred in the 1980s, the boomer prosecutors investigated every detail, made thousands of criminal referrals, and had numerous convictions. And if you don't believe me, talk to Bill Black. He was in charge of that, and I've had him on the show through YouTube recordings quite frequently, so you're all familiar with him, I hope, those of you who've been listening for any length of time. But you know, today the Justice Department refuses to investigate and prosecute the crimes that were committed. And of course, this is a huge difference with the Gen X culture. Boomers had no problem prosecuting other boomers, but Gen Xers adamantly refused to investigate and blame each other, even for serious crimes. And so that if there are only a few dishonest Gen Xers, they can do an enormous amount of damage, simply because they can commit crimes at will and count on just not being punished by Gen X prosecutors. And this, of course, has huge consequences, as Gen X financial engineers could and can commit serious crimes freely. And, you know, it's even worse than that, because Gen X regulators and prosecutors have actually encouraged continued fraud. You know, in 2008, I talked about Gen X New York Insurance Superintendent Eric DiNello, who not only didn't prosecute the banksters at Citibank and others, but actually arranged for them to continue defrauding the public and investors. At a recent 60 Minutes investigation, they showed that the Obama Justice Department adamantly refused to investigate and prosecute this bankster fraud, even in the face of massive evidence of fraud. And you know, that's exactly the kind of culture that prevailed in 1930s Nazi Germany. It was possible to rob, defraud, assault, or even kill a Jew for revenge. And these actions were not only not investigated and prosecuted by German officials, they were actually encouraged and supported by officials all the way up to Hitler himself. And this is exactly the same kind of generational behavior we've been seeing today. The relationship between Gen Xers and boomers is hardly unique in history. The generation that grew up after the Civil War was called the missionary generation, and you can just imagine them from their name, how similar they were to the boomers that grew up after World War II. The missionary generation created societal chaos that the next generation, known as the lost generation, came to hate them for. It's the lost generation that's the archetypal ancestor of Gen X. America's lost generation hated the missionary generation even before World War I. But that hatred became palpable after the war, which they blamed entirely on the missionaries. World War I was a political disaster for Germany. From the point of view of generational dynamics, World War I for Germany was not at all like World War II, but was generationally equivalent to the 1960s Vietnam War for America. Germany fought the war half-heartedly. There was a vigorous anti-war movement that turned the public against the war. And finally, Germany was forced to capitulate, not because they were defeated on the battlefield, but because they were defeated politically at home by their anti-war movement. The Treaty of Versailles that followed the war was highly punitive to Germany, and Germany was completely humiliated. Germany's lost generation blamed the war, the subsequent hyperinflation, and even the 1929 stock market crash on the missionary generation, especially the Jews who were associated with that generation. Robbing, defrauding, assaulting, or even killing a Jew was no problem because it was revenge for the war and the financial collapses. To them, it wasn't genocide. It was justice. Gen Xers also feel it's Justice Today with me, Defraud Boomers. Well, there you have it, some kind of a historical context which may or may not be valid, but it's one attempt to cover the tracks. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you're all familiar with Obama's new task force, the Mortgage Origination and Securitization Abuses. In the setup of the office, four aspects are crucial. Does the office have subpoena power, as the New York Attorney General's office has got through the Martin Act? Are there going to be public hearings, preferably in the Senate? Will the commission have a significant budget? Will it be a forum for whistleblowers and crowdsourcing? Because without such powers, the office will be a farce, helping to shield banks from the fallout of their wrongdoings. What the office investigates will also reveal how serious this is. Both pre- and post-crisis topics should be investigated, including MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, which was created by banks without any authority or enabling legislation. It allowed the rapid transfer of mortgages, avoiding state and county filing fees amounting to billions of dollars. Because, you know, without MERS, it's hard to imagine that the massive volume of mortgage securitizations could have occurred. How were lenders able to circumvent mortgage filings with town and county registrars? Did they engage in illegalities? How many billions of dollars do they owe in fees for transferred notes? And what percentage of MERS assignments were fraudulent, made for entities that didn't exist? Origination fraud. Why did lenders accept stated income loans? Why did they abandon traditional standards? Michael White, a countrywide subprime unit employee, called this origination fraud, observing, quote, "Eliminate the verification of income for a mortgage borrower and you eliminate your ability to predict the likelihood of repayment or default," end of quote. And then we have RMBS, Wall Street Securitized Mortgage Pools, Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities, which contained a broad variety of flaws, some so egregious that they amounted to fraud. In plain English, we're talking about bad paperwork and misrepresented pools of mortgages to borrowers whose debts were significantly understated and whose median incomes and credit scores were significantly overstated. And then we have insurance fraud. Look at the bank tactic in which legitimate home insurance is cancelled and new insurance provided at a substantially higher fee through a subsidiary or affiliate of the bank mortgage holder. This extra expense, in some cases, led to foreclosures. How about pyramid servicing fees? An illegal practice in which current payments are applied to past late fees, generating more late fees and additional interest owed and creating a delinquency where none existed. This tactic also led to foreclosures that were probably unlawful. Then we have lost mortgage notes. How is it possible that the most important part of the mortgage contract, the promissory note, was consistently lost or misplaced by banks? It is unfathomable to anyone who has ever handled documents. At best, it's gross incompetence. At worst, it's willful document destruction during litigation. How about document fraud for sale? There were many examples of alleged document fraud, but the one crying out for investigation involves Lender Processing Services, DOCX subsidiary. The firm seems to have been selling fabricated documents for a fee to lawyers and banks. Indeed, Lender Processing Services, which processes nearly half of all U.S. foreclosures, could require a separate investigation. Then we have false affidavits, perjury, robo-signing. We do not know who ordered the robo-signing of foreclosure documents, the false notarizations, fraudulent written statements to courts and perjury. This should be easy to investigate, like flipping a nickel bag dealer to get the drug kingpin. Astoundingly, this easy-to-investigate felony by a notarized perjurious statement submitted to foreclosure court has yet to be prosecuted. How about foreclosure mills, process servers? Law firms engaged in rampant fraud that corrupted the foreclosure process. If found guilty, those people should be disbarred and jailed. Same for the sewer service processor servers who threw away legally required notices to delinquent homeowners. Oh yeah, and how about the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act? You know, federal law protects active duty service members from foreclosure and eviction. I find violation of the law reprehensible. If it were up to me, I'd let the special forces, Navy SEALs, and Army Green Berets handle this as they see fit. Even with criminal statutes of limitations elapsing, we can achieve some measure of justice against the crisis wrongdoers. Lawyers can be disbarred and corporate insiders banned from servicing in publicly held firms again. CEOs and CFOs can be fired. A significant investigation with subpoena powers, a real budget, and public hearings would go a long way towards restoring public confidence. So, ladies and gentlemen, is this going to happen? Is Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, who's just been given responsibility for all this, is he going to step up to the plate? Or is this some cruel, cynical act on the part of the administration to hire them into service just before the elections? Well, all I can say is, we shall see. Nothing else will do. All right, another couple of emails. Al Berry writes in with a quote about Meredith Whitney, who says she is not backing down from her position on state and municipal finances, as she says they'll lead to further cuts in social services, which will fuel more social unrest. And the question is, dear Richard, do you agree with Meredith Whitney? Are we already Europe? Is there a safer investment than U.S. Treasury bills? Thank you, Al Berry. Well, Al, sorry, but if you don't like money under the mattress, and I'm not too thrilled with that idea, there really isn't a better deal than U.S. Treasury bills. And I'll tell you why, and I've said this before, but I think it bears with repeating. U.S. Treasury bills are the last in line of investments on which the U.S. government will default. And this means that you will have plenty of warning in case the U.S. government really does start defaulting on its debt one after another. But up to now, there's been no evidence that the U.S. government has the slightest intention of defaulting on anything. So really, you have time on your hands. And added to which, U.S. Treasury bills are very close maturity bills, which means they only go out to about 180 days. They are not going to decline in value should you find it necessary to liquidate them. So don't worry about it, ladies and gentlemen. U.S. Treasury bills are absolutely fine. They're not going to do you any harm, and you will not have to worry about liquidating them if in the unlikely event all hell should break loose, that the entire system should crumble before your eyes. You will have so much notice that I will be here to tell you way in advance of what you may need to do to protect yourselves from the ravages of what may come down the pike to visit you. I came across something from David Galland at Casey's Daily Dispatch, which I thought you might be interested in. It's an excerpt from a new book written by an ex-soldier who proudly advertises himself as the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history. And to give you a sense of the excerpt, the following is a snippet in which he describes his feelings after having shot an Iraqi woman who, according to his assessment, was about to toss a grenade in the direction of the invading American forces. "My shot saved several Americans whose lives were clearly worth more than that woman's twisted soul. I can stand before God with a clear conscience about doing my job. But I truly, deeply hated the evil that woman possessed. I hate it to this day. Savage, despicable evil. That's what we were fighting in Iraq. That's why a lot of people, myself included, called the enemy savages. There really was no other way to describe what we encountered there. People ask me all the time, how many have you killed? My standard response is, does the answer make me less or more of a man? The number is not important to me. I only wish I had killed more. Not for the bragging rights, but because I believe the world is a better place without savages out there taking American lives. Everyone I shot in Iraq was trying to harm Americans or Iraqis loyal to the new government. I don't even know where to begin evaluating the comments of this man. For example, the fact that it made no impact on him, that subsequent to the war's end, it was clear to all that the underlying rationale for invasion was unjustifiable and the outcome both devastating and counterproductive. Saddam had no weapons of mass destruction, and even if he did, he couldn't have deployed them against the United States anyway. Furthermore, by removing his unifying presence, heavy-handed though it may have been, their problem, not ours. The U.S. opened the door to a much larger role for Iran in the region, pretty much the exact opposite of stated U.S. foreign policy. On a more human level, if the tides had been turned and it had been Iraqis marching through American streets, the sniper would have been the first to call the woman he describes as being so evil a freedom fighter and a hero. Then there is overt religiosity expressed in his views. It is, in my opinion, one thing to find solace in the quiet meditations and communal warmth of your local church, synagogue, temple, whatever. It's an altogether different thing to claim it is God's will that you travel to foreign lands and shoot people through the head. But you know, that's not what's most concerning. What's most concerning, and the reason I mentioned Zeitgeist, is that this article was posted on Huffington Post, a website whose audience has been considered very liberal-leaning and mostly anti-war. Moreover, rather than evoke any sort of intellectual discourse or adamant pushback, the following on letters and comments at the bottom of the article were almost entirely unquestioning and enthusiastically supportive. A representative example. It is good to see and hear of the bad guys being taken out by this sniper. Those evildoers want to destroy America. Americans must stop them. Good work, boy. God bless America. In God we trust. I am perfectly serious when I tell you that I no longer know what it means to be an American. The principles we stand for have become blurred, to say the least. To me, it appears that there is a large and seriously deranged subset of people living in this country without any moral compass whatsoever. Can it be long before I'm rounded up and dealt with in a manner that doesn't technically break any law, wink, wink, but ultimately has a very bad result? When you have the readers of a perfect planet website such as Huffington Post agreeing with the hardest of the hardcore aficionados of scorched earth foreign policy, it should come as a surprise to no one when the nation finishes its slide into authoritarianism. Of course, as America is still viewed as a thought leader for governments around the world, much of the world will likely follow down the same slope. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, the system inevitably drags the overwhelming majority of people into its net. So even people you know who are the most critical about what's going on may very well be unrecognizable to you in the future. This is just a warning. Constantly question yourselves and any changing attitudes you might find yourselves adopting. You know, this can happen to the best of us. And I say this because, you know, frankly, when you think that right now the administration is busy putting into place systems where you can be accused of talking against the government or by association against America, it's a hop, skip, and a jump to find your own views about these things inculcated into a sense of where the government considers you a terrorist, and the views of Bush, which was you're either for us or against us, become traitorous views in the minds of the people who want to keep the views of the government together in one piece, and then you find yourself disappeared and incommunicado with the rest of the world, including your family and your lawyers. This is what you have to look forward to, ladies and gentlemen. This is what is coming. And it is very, very frightening. And that's one of the reasons why you can't win with these people. They will win over you in the end, and it will wear you down to the point at which you no longer dare disagree with them. And I'm telling you these things now where there is still time to move. You know, sometimes I wonder if you ever get the feeling that the world around you is going crazy. If you live in America today and you're not in a television-induced coma, you've probably had that feeling. It seems like almost everywhere you turn these days and there is someone seriously losing it. And it's not just our politicians. In every profession and on every level of society, there are lots of people that appear to be a few fries short of a happy meal. So what do you do when the country where you live is literally going insane? When paranoia, fear, and delusional thinking are commonplace? It's very difficult for a society to function normally. And unfortunately, some of the craziest people out there are working for the federal government. These days, you literally do not know who you can count on. If you contact someone in a position of authority, that person may help you, or that person may turn out to be a raving lunatic. Once upon a time, there was a feeling that most people in America had shared sets of common values. But those days are long gone. These days, it seems like nearly everyone has their own idea of what is right and wrong. And so when you meet someone, you never know what you're going to get. What may seem totally insane to you may seem perfectly normal to the person you're trying to interact with. All right, well, let's take a couple more emails. Just one came in a few minutes ago from Van Presley, who says, "Hi, Richard, do you ever watch or listen to Max Kaiser? He keeps talking about gold being good and the dollar being bad. You seem to think the opposite. Can you get him on your show? And if not, can you address what he's saying on your show? I emailed Max to get you on his show, but got no response. Van." Well, thank you, Van. I am familiar with Max Kaiser, and he does a pretty good job, I think, of drawing our attention to what's really going on. He does this for a full-time living, so I don't claim to be anywhere near his level of competence when it comes to bringing you the news and views, but you know, he does interview a lot of people, and I like his sidekick very much indeed. And frankly, I'm not so sure about his view about gold and the dollar. I do happen to think the dollar is going to rally from here. I think it's do very well. Gold will have a very hard time in the near future, but who knows? It's a little late in the show to actually talk about gold right now, and I've talked about it a lot in the past. So anyway, let's finish with an email from Gilbert Definich, who says, "Hi, Richard. This is really amazing to me. I know high-end residential contractors and interior designers in New York City. They are all having a difficult time. If they announced 7% unemployment, would the stock market jump up even further? I'm wondering when reality will prevail in the market. I'm thinking that if the Dow reaches 40,000, I'll short every last penny. Regards, Gilbert." Well, this is a very disturbing time for those of us who really have their eye viewed and focused on the future. We do know that the economy is not making progress. I'm sending out material to my email distribution list several times a day. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you feel like joining in, please do write to me and let me know and give me your name and phone number, because I do need them both, and I will put you on my list. But I think that the market is truly overextended at this point, and that it will turn. And I don't talk that much about the market on my shows, but those of you who believe, as I do, that the market will go down, keep the faith. It is going to happen, ladies and gentlemen, and we are very close, and that is my opinion. And I'm hoping that you will agree with me, and that you will have the courage to see this thing through, because it is very disturbing right now, as I'm sure many of you will be aware. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's the show for today. I'll be back on, I'll be back on Friday. So have a great week. This is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call saying, until then.